You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Welcome, everyone, to NSPS Radio Hour for another edition. And here we are, March 24th already. And I guess I need to say, so everyone hears me well, happy birthday to my wife today. Today is her birthday. She doesn't listen to the show, but she may be asking some of my friends, Jack, so I guess I better say that. What do you think? I have Jack Owens with me today. Welcome to the show, Jack.
Thank you.
Jack is going to talk with us today about the Indiana-Michigan state line. I see in the piece you provided it's called the quiet boundary, so we can talk about that as we move ahead. But as is our want here on the show, we try to provide information and entertainment and maybe not advice so much. Sometimes we do give advice, I guess, but we really just want our listeners to be able to hear a broad scope of the types of things that surveyors get involved in. And I've been not directly involved with so much, Jack, but at least around a number of these kind of things that have gone on. I think you and I might have even talked about some of our preliminary conversations about where these types of surveys have occurred in along state boundaries between other states in recent years.
Yeah.
So I guess the good way to start the show would be just to have you introduce yourself to the folks on the show, a little bit about your background and how you got involved in this effort, and then we'll begin to talk about it.
Okay. Yeah, I'm a resident of Michigan. I'm a licensed surveyor in the state of Michigan, and one of the things I've done in that regard is our society as a pre-licensure review class for people that are going to take the licensing exam. So I give the part on the GLO survey history and on BLM retracements and subdivision of sections and, you know, that area. And it's a two-day class that's presented. So in one of the classes, somebody questioned about the state boundaries, and so I really couldn't answer his question. I knew that two of them had been resurveyed. In the past, the Michigan-Ohio border and the Wisconsin-Michigan border. So I looked into it and found out the Indiana border was originally surveyed in 1827, and that was the last time that anything been done along the border as far as defining it. And so that kind of intrigued me, and so I looked into it some more and decided to present a paper about it to our society. I went over the history of the line, how it got formed, and also the current status. The issue of the border is that it was monumented with wood posts in 1827, and anybody with a survey background knows that 180-year-old posts are long gone. They've all rotted away. So, I in my paper, I called for a resurvey of the line. So that's kind of how I got interested in it.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. What you were talking about doing the review class and questions coming up. That's one of the things I've always found to be really interesting and kind of exciting in a way, is when you're presenting classes like that. And in your case, if it's for the license review, for the examination review, you're kind of getting the fresh meat, so to speak. Because we go to do the ones for continuing education, and obviously that's generally speaking are people who already hold the license, just getting their CEUs. But I've been fortunate enough to do some of those pre-licensure review classes as well in Virginia in particular. And I've always found that to be really, really interesting, because you're getting questions from and ideas from and people who are just kind of coming into to the business. And it seems to me sometimes we kind of get caught up in our own selves as surveyors, and we don't think back to what our thought processes were back in those days. So I always thought that was really cool to do that and hear the things that come up.
Right, yeah. But yeah, I was going to say the reason I called the quiet boundary is Michigan-Ohio boundary was always contentious in the beginning, and Michigan-Wisconsin border, it wasn't controversial at the beginning, but when they were going to resurvey it about in the 1920s, Michigan-Wisconsin got into an argument and went before the Supreme Court over that. So whereas the Indiana-Michigan border is just kind of set there perking along, you know, and hasn't stirred up any real controversy. So.
Yeah, I've heard some stories from surveyors in Michigan and Ohio about that particular boundary. I don't remember exactly what the issues were, but there wasn't a pig involved or something, was there? Maybe I'm mixing that up with something else. But
yeah, well, that's the Michigan-Ohio border.
Yeah, Michigan-Ohio. That's the one I was talking about, yeah.
Yeah. The issue there was there were two definitions of the boundary. We get into a little bit of the history of it, but at the end of the Revolutionary War, the Great Britain and the U.S. signed a peace treaty, and so Britain gave up all their claims all the way west of the Mississippi. So basically, the U.S. at least doubled in size, if not more. So they they came up with the boundary of the Mississippi, and they went through the Great Lakes because Great Britain, they sailed all over the world, and did commerce, so they wanted to be able to sail up the Great Lakes. Navigability was a big issue with them. Anyway, at that time, there's kind of three things happened in the 1780s. One was that there were, of the 13 colonies, eight of them had claims to land extending west. Some of them claimed land that extended west of the Pacific, And they were overlapping claims and stuff. But they were forming the, Continental Congress. And so they had to have unanimous agreement on that. So the states that didn't have those land claims didn't like the fact that some states were going to claim bigger areas than they already occupied. So they wouldn't sign, especially Maryland, I guess it was, wouldn't sign the Articles of the Confederation until the landed states gave up their claims to all these territories. So they came to agreement that they'd form new states out of that land. And then after the Revolutionary War ended, two other big bills were passed that really affected the state development and surveying. One was the Land Ordinance in 1785. That was the beginning of the public land survey system. So that's basically how it was applied to all the land all the way west from Ohio to, all the way out to California. And part of that was that the government was broke. They needed money, and they wanted to sell it to people that wanted to settle. But they wanted to have it surveyed ahead of time. And the other big issue was governing the area. And they passed the Northwest Ordinance in 1787. And that kind of gave a formulation of how new states would be developed. And in how they would be governed. You know, it specified the laws they would have, and it got into several other issues. One of which was kind of a prickly subject. That they said that the Northwest Territories there would be no slavery, and of course the Southern states didn't like that. So before a state was ever formed under the Northwest Ordinance in the Northwest Territory, which was, you know, north of the Ohio River, Tennessee and Kentucky came into existence. And I think it was, a lot of it had to do with they wanted states formed that weren't formed under this formula that, you know, there would be no slavery in a new state. So, you know, it's like everything else, you know, politics, how it's developed, any plan that comes up, you know, the government undertakes.
Yeah, that is so true. So, you know, as you were talking about that, being a Virginian, we look back at those old maps and think, boy, if Virginia had kept all the land that was in Virginia at one time, we'd have had a whole lot more presidents come from our state. There have been a lot of presidents come from some of the states that came out of Virginia. But, yeah, I guess I hadn't really thought about that part of it, what you were just talking about in terms of the Northwest Territory development. And it had never occurred to me, really, that Kentucky and Tennessee formed before that happened and why. Makes sense is probably not the right word to put it, but it helps you understand perhaps how it occurred.
Right, yeah, because the Northwest Ordinance was passed, but before a state was ever developed in the Northwest Territory, they created those two states. And I think the other state was New Hampshire.
Okay. Obviously not for the same reasons.
Yeah, right. I don't know what led to their development.
Right. Yeah, well, that's really interesting stuff. And as it turns out, we are probably a minute or so away from our next break, so we won't get too much into the other part of that. But I thought it was important to cover some background there, and particularly since we had talked a little bit about the other boundaries, I guess. But before we go to great, maybe a compelling question to ask was, since there was contentiousness on the Michigan-Ohio line, and then eventually I'd like to learn more about what happened in the 20s with Wisconsin, but I guess since there was no conflict on the boundary with Indiana, you needed to survey it so you could find some, I guess. Maybe he said jokingly. But nevertheless, let's go to the first break. We'll be right back.
Okay. All right.
Getting into underground utility location? If so, you'll want to know about the Schonstadt Instrument Company's MPC kit, a multi-purpose combo for locating both ferrous objects and underground pipes and cables. And because it consists of two instruments in one package, it qualifies for trade-in allowances on two locators. Any kind, any make, any condition. Contact your dealer for details or visit www.schonstadt.com. That's SCHONSTEDT.com.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about quick stakes, go to www.quickstake.com, or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
Attention surveyors, are you aware that yellow stick you're using is saving lives all over the world? Yes, that Pinfinder is clearing fields and villages of unexploded cluster bombs and other hidden explosives in over 25 countries.
Yes, I try to stay hungry
because if I eat,
I just keep
getting in cooperation with international mine action programs provides free locators to where they are most urgently needed. To find out how you can help, visit the NSPS website at nsps.us.com. And thank you.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com. The pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
back, everyone. We're with Jack Owens today. We're talking about state boundaries in general, and more specifically about the Indiana-Michigan boundary. It's good information, Jack, during that first session. It's always interesting to, as you said, think about what the logic was, or perhaps the illogic. I'm not sure which the case is, but how the boundaries get formed, and particularly, I guess, more so here east of the Mississippi, because obviously we can look out west and, for the most part, see some fairly clean lines. But here on our end of the world, and of course in Michigan, you've got some really interesting boundary lines all the way around, and then considering, of course, that you have the UP up there. I've said it on the radio show before, but you know John Matanich, of course, and John and I are great friends. He and I agreed one time that if you go far enough north, like to the UP, the folks think like we Southerners do. So, but it's certainly an interesting state, no doubt about that. I've been fortunate enough to travel through a good part of it, including up into the UP, and drove across it from Marquette all the way over to Bessemer to visit with John once.
Oh, yeah.
Very, very interesting place.
Really over the west, yeah.
Yeah, it's right on the border over there, that's for sure. And you, as a matter of fact, you were talking about that in the beginning. Maybe that'd be of interest to our folks here for a couple of minutes, too, to talk about. We talked about the Ohio conflict, and then you said that the Wisconsin side really didn't have any issues until they resurveyed it or something back in the 20s?
Yeah, the issue there, of course, turned out to be money. They had, discovered iron ore, and copper ore. And when the border was surveyed, it was specified to run from the head of the, whatever it was, Montreal River, I think it was, southwesterly to the middle of a lake, and then deflect and go to the outlet of a river on another lake. But William Burt surveyed it. So he ran a random line at first, and it went south of the final line. So when they, when they discovered all this iron ore up there and copper ore and stuff, and Michigan, wanted to get more of the land, so they tried to claim the temporary line, the random line. But that ended up in the Supreme Court. And, basically the Supreme Court said, well, you've occupied the other line for 75 years. We don't see how you can claim to another line you've never used. So, they did re-survey it and, put in concrete markers.
Right. I guess it kind of gets back to a lot of things over time, whether it be state boundaries or, in some cases, individual boundaries. What's accepted oftentimes in the courts makes more sense than perhaps what somebody wrote down somewhere along the way.
Yeah.
And certainly, I guess it does for the people who live along those borders, for sure.
Right.
Getting back just a little bit on the formation of your group, I guess when after your paper and you began to have conversations about it, and this was obviously way before either state decided, the state government that themselves decided to get involved in it, you guys were already had your own volunteer group looking into it, didn't you?
Yes. Like I said, I presented a paper in 2002, and then in 2004 we formed a volunteer ad hoc, we call it a survey study committee, and we started meeting irregularly and trying to recover corners on the line. George Warnicky was the one that got us going. He's he likes action, he doesn't like talking, so he's the kind of guy that if you're talking to him in the corner of a room, people might not hear your part of the conversation, but they're going to hear his half.
I actually know George fairly well. I've been involved with him in providing some workshops in around different places where he's been, and he's a great guy, but you're certainly going to hear him when he talks.
So we've had about, you know, probably 15 people or so meeting since 2004, and we've done a couple different things. We compiled, you know, some data. We researched the county survey records to see if there was any information about the mileposts, because didn't seem to be much use of them. And so we started looking for evidence of them to, you know, see if they're could be recovered or not. And it's kind of interesting. Beginning of Norm call on John Klein, two surveyors in Michigan, they went out with a handheld GPS and spent a couple days walking along the line and getting a position wherever they could find something that they thought looked like the line, you know, whether it was a closing corners or roads or fence lines or whatever. So anyway, we ended up with a map, and it showed the alignment according to the occupation. It was run as a parallel latitude, but from just the handheld GPS data, we could see it varied north and south as it went along about over 600 feet north and south as it wanders back and forth. And,
with all that research, obviously you were delving pretty deeply into the history of the line to begin with. What brought it about, I guess?
Yeah, if we go back a little bit on the history that we didn't get into yet, Northwest Territory was formed, and they appointed a governor under the terms of the act. And so it started growing pretty rapidly, especially Ohio. So that became a state by 1802, 1803. And that's the part that affected the Indiana line. The Northwest Ordinance said that there would be a minimum of three states, and the boundary would start at the mouth of the Great Miami River on the Ohio and go north, and that's the Ohio-Indiana line. The other line would go up the Wabash River to, Vincennes or something, then go due north. That's the Indiana-Illinois line. But then they said if they had, for expediency's sake, they could form other states by running a due east-west line to the southern extreme of Lake Michigan. So Ohio, when they wrote their constitution, they were not sure that that line would include Toledo. Some people told them it wouldn't. So they used the ordinance line, the east-west line, but they also put in a provisionary line. They said with acceptance of Congress, they could run from the north Cape of Maumee Bay, which is the north side of Toledo, run south-southwesterly to, west-southwesterly to the south line of Lake Michigan. So the only thing was Congress didn't do anything because nobody knew what the, what the condition actually was. You know, the line had never been run. But anyway, so that just kind of hung there. Then the Territory of Michigan was formed, and they used the ordinance line for that boundary, even though Ohio's constitution had this other provisionary line. So Indiana and Illinois started growing quite rapidly, and by about 1815, they had 60,000 population, and in the Northwest Ordinance, they only needed 50,000, so they petitioned Congress for statehood. So that's where, the interesting thing my research disclosed. You know, you start getting into intrigue. In 1816, on January 2nd, the this petition got assigned to a committee chaired by Ohio Senator, Senator Moreau. And then the fifth, the House committee was chaired by Representative Jennings, which I find interesting because it wasn't a state yet, so he really wasn't seated. But anyway, he reported out his bill with the North Line being this ordinance line, due east and west. So then April 3rd, it got sent back to the Senate and assigned to a new committee, but Senator Moreau got the next day, he gets the House bill assigned to his committee again. Then the next day, on the 4th, he comes out with an amendment defining the North Line being 10 miles north of this southerly extreme of Lake Michigan. And that got passed and signed by the House concurred, and then Senator Madison signed it in April 19th.
So was the reason for that the Toledo thing?
Well, see, it's kind of, you know, people are not sure why he did it, but I think he's looking out. He just wanted for Ohio's interest. You know, he was an
sure.
Ohio senator.
Yep.
And indirectly, he could break Michigan's claim that you had to use the ordinance line. See, if he makes another state boundary 10 miles north of it, but it's not the Ohio boundary, then he strengthened Ohio's argument that, you know, we don't have to use the ordinance line. So it's just, you know, political intrigue to me. But anyway, that's what happened. So then the Indiana had a constitutional convention, and they confirmed the boundary that was in the Congressional Act that formed the state. And Michigan Territory, they protested, but at that time, that area, that boundary was just wild land. You know, there wasn't anybody out there. And plus Michigan, they didn't have any power in Congress. Ohio was a state, you know, they had senators and representatives, and Michigan, you know, had a non-voting representative in the House. That was it. So they kind of got steamrolled by the whole process. So we end up by 1816, the boundary is 10 miles north. Forget the ordinance line.
Well, we're right on our next break. When we come back, we'll talk about the survey and what that led
okay,
to and move on
that.
From there.
Yeah. Right.
Attention surveyors, are you aware that yellow stick you're using is saving lives all over the world? Yes, that pinfinder is clearing fields and villages of unexploded cluster bombs and other hidden explosives in over 25 countries. Johnstead, in cooperation with international mine action programs, provides free locators to where they are most urgently needed. To find out how you can help, visit the NSPS website at nsps.us.com. And thank you.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on americaswebradio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on americaswebradio.com anytime you like.
Quick steaks are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden steaks, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about Quick Steaks, go to www.quicksteak.com, or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
Schonstedt Instrument Company has been making locating easier since 1953. First, with its yellow stick, the GA52CX, the industry standard for sensitivity. Then, the GA72CD, a shorter and more rugged version offering a magnetic polarity display and a battery and sensitivity indicator. And most recently, the GA92XT, built for portability. It retracts to fit in its holster and extends for one-handed operation and fingertip control. See them all at Schonstedt.com. That's Schonstedt.com.
You're listening to americaswebradio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back, everyone. We're here today with Jack Owens talking about the Indiana-Michigan line. And as our normal listeners know, this is the time of the show each week that we have our contest from our sponsor, Parker Davis Quick Stakes, the Quick Stakes Contest. The first person to email to quickstakescontest@americaswebradio.com after I ask the question and the answer is given will win the gift certificate or prize today from the sponsor. So in speaking of that line, Jack, you mentioned early on there was a name that I don't know if it's the official name of the line, but certainly the name that is part of what your paper was for that line, and you had a specific name for that line.
Yeah, the quiet boundary.
The quiet boundary. So for our listeners, that's the answer to today's question, that the Michigan-Indiana line is known as the quiet boundary. Before we went to break, you were talking about all of the machinations that got to setting the line, and then I guess at some point thereafter, somebody had to try to put it on the ground, had to have it surveyed.
Yeah, well, like you say, it was at the time of the statehood, that was just kind of wild land. You know, settlement in Indiana started in the south near the Vincennes Tract, and their survey started down there. The second principal meridian was baseline were established at the south end of the state. So they moved north, and the Michigans began over in the southeast corner of the state. So the surveys there were moving north and west. And so by the mid-1820s, they had finally gotten over into this area of the Indiana boundary. It was, you know, it was specified, but it had never been surveyed. So Congress finally authorized a survey of it. There was a couple Indian treaties in there, and so they had obtained the land from the from these Indians under the, you know, 1785 land ordinance. They always obtained title from the Indians before they would do survey. So anyway, they got those two treaties, so that made that area available for survey and settlement. So the Congress authorized the survey, and what they decided to do, you know, they had different ways they could survey a state boundary, but in this case they decided to use the General Land Office and have the Surveyor General do the survey, you know, contracted out. They didn't always use that method, but that's what they used here. And a fellow by the name of Eliezer Kendrick was hired as a deputy surveyor under contract with the General Land Office. This is the only contract he ever held as a deputy surveyor. He had been working in Tiffin's office, the Surveyor General office, for 6 years. He was a clerk. The Surveyor General, the clerks, they did a lot of stuff. There was a lot of copying going on. They didn't have copy machines, for one thing. The only time the Surveyor General wrote a letter, it had to get copied, you know, so they had a record of it before it was sent out. You know, they had to, they were recopying the notes, making copies of notes. So, you know, they had several clerks. Tiffin's salary was about $2,000 a year back then. These clerks were making like $1,000. So, you know, that was a fairly, you know, good paying job. I think the most interesting thing is that how Kendrick transitioned into this job of the survey. Tiffin's daughter was, he had one daughter. She was about to get married. And so Tiffin was worried about how the son-in-law would be able to support his daughter. So apparently he talked Kendrick into surrendering his clerk's job and going out and doing the survey. You know, he kind of was tossed in as a as a parting gift or what. But, you know, I always thought that must have been an interesting conversation.
I can imagine. So did he end up getting extra money for doing that?
No, he just got paid at the regular rate. He was a surveyor. You know, he was seemed to be a, you know, a fairly competent surveyor. So he began down at the southern extreme of Lake Michigan because they had to be 10 miles north. Okay, that was the, that's the way the Indiana boundary read, according to that act. So he started, like, on October 8th, he found Harris, I hadn't mentioned that, but 1817, Tiffin had a deputy surveyor named Harris run that line due east from the south end of Lake Michigan all the way over to the Toledo area. And then they found out the Indiana or the Ohio border, you know, the Toledo area was north of that ordnance line. So in 1817, he had the line run according to the Ohio Constitution, which is, you know, made Michigan mad, of course. But, you know, he was Ohio's first governor, so even though he's a good surveyor general, he's definitely had, you know, his viewpoint on how things should be. But anyway, so he starts out down there, and Kendrick did. He recovers Harris's post from 1817, and he runs a couple miles and finds a couple more, so he confirms he's got it. So then he starts surveying, going up the shoreline, up the, you know, it's all sandy beach. He just starts running a traverse. So his notes consist of a series of traverse lines, bearings, and distances. And so he keeps running north, and he's using the bearings and his distances, he computes the latitudes and departures. And we probably ought to explain that since a lot of young surveyors don't have the computer.
Yeah, I still remember using those old sheets. You remember that?
Right. Well, in this case, because of a compass, even at that time, even before that time, they had tables made up for every quarter of a degree, and then they had the distances below them, you know, one chain, two chains, three chains, all the way up to 100 chains for each quarter of a degree, and then they gave the, if you multiply the sine and the cosine times the bearing, you would get your course would be the hypotenuse of a right triangle. So by multiplying by sine and cosine, you could compute the other two sides. The north-south distance would be the latitude. East-west component side would be the departure. So he just kept adding up his increments north, his latitudes, until they totaled 800 chains. And then he considered that he was 10 miles north. That was, you know, that was good enough for, you know, his process. So he got there, started on 8th, so he got on 11th. Took him 3 days to get up there. He makes a Polaris observation because he had to adjust his compass so he could run due east, you know, using the compass to index the sight veins and the compass block. So, you know, the sight veins would point due east and the compass block would be pointing according to the magnetic needle. So anyway, he just starts out going due east, and took him 17 days to lay out the line. It was 105 miles wide. So he just went across every mile. He'd set a post, and just like a typical public land survey system process, there'd be two bearing trees. He'd, you know, blaze those and scribe them. And so then when he, but he had kept track of his departures, his east-west distances as well, because 1817 Harris had measured all the way to the Indiana-Ohio border. He had that distance. So by having kept track of all his departures and then the east-west distance for the Indiana line, he knew when he was about due north of the Ohio-Indiana line. So he sets milepost 105, then he goes down 10 miles south, goes back to the Harris line, and which was on the Indiana-Ohio line, and he starts measuring due north, setting posts on that line. And then the next day he intersects his two lines and sets the post. It's interesting. Every time he set a post, he just said set post. But for the northeast corner, he said set 6-inch square white oak post. He described it exactly what it was. So
you just left to guess what the others were.
Yeah, well, you know, that was the easiest way to do it. You know, that's the way everything was done in the,
right,
in Michigan, because, you know, it was all wood, so you just cut down a sapling and sharpen a stake, and, you know, you make a post. But here he squared one up. And instead of having two bearings, which is the typical, he had eight bearing trees, this reference. So he must have considered it the most important of his of all his posts he set there. So
earlier you said something about explaining what latitude and departure is.
Yeah.
With computerization today, I'm not so sure you don't have to explain what sine and cosine is.
Yeah, yeah. I assume that you know, anybody with a survey background, you know, has taken trigonometry.
Oh yeah, certainly anybody listening to this program is going to know.
Yeah,
no question about that.
Yeah, my cousin, he taught calculus at Ferris State College. You know how when they came out with the electronic calculators and they all had sine, cosine, and tangent function,
yep,
keys on them? And he says, well, they don't need that tangent key. All you got to do is divide the sine by the cosine. You got the tangent.
Just a wasted button, huh?
Yeah. And his I said, well, geez, give us a break.
Yeah, that's pretty funny.
So anyway, and at the east line, when he measured 10 miles north and intersected his line, he was 9 miles and 64 chains. He was no longer 10 chains. But since the Harris line had been run due east with a compass, and the Indiana-Michigan line had been run due east with a compass, you know, that's probably as good as you could expect them to do, you know, in that work that they did. He took a Polaris observations 10 times in running his line. You know, any night that he could see it, he would observe Polaris and correct his, you know, his compass, the declination setting on his compass. Variation, as he called it.
So he's pretty diligent.
Oh, yeah, and he said, I observed all my back sights, you know, which meant, you know, if you were looking for local attraction, that's what you're supposed to do. Is,
right.
You know, when you move ahead, you sighted your back sight, and you're supposed to have the same bearing. You know?
We need to go to our last break here. We'll come back and follow up with what you've learned to date.
Yeah.
Attention surveyors. Are you aware that that yellow stick you're using is saving lives all over the world? Yes, that pinfinder is clearing fields and villages of unexploded cluster bombs and other hidden explosives in over 25 countries. Johnstead, in cooperation with international mine action programs, provides free locators to where they are most urgently needed. To find out how you can help, visit the NSPS website at nsps.us.com, and thank you.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
Quick steaks are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden steaks, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about Quick Steaks, go to www.quicksteak.com, or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back, everyone, to our last segment today with Jack Owens talking about the Michigan-Indiana Quiet Line. We've talked about some history and how things were developed and the concept for laying that line, and talked about some of the surveying that went on. So I guess now that both governors have officially assigned people to the, is it called a committee? I'm not sure if that's the right word.
Well, it's a commission.
A commission, yeah.
The Boundary Line Commission is what
and that,
that's what it's called.
That last part of that just occurred recently, right?
Yeah, the Michigan governor just appointed the five Michigan members in February, and Governor Snyder and then Governor Pence of Indiana appointed the five Indiana commissioners in December. So
right.
They haven't had a chance to do anything yet.
Right. That hasn't stopped you guys from doing research, though. You've been researching all along, right?
Oh, yeah. The guy that got interested before any of us was John McNamara. He's a county surveyor in St. Joe County, Indiana, which is South Bend area. And he transcribed the original survey notes, so we had that. So from that, we know there are 124 posts out there were set to define the line. There's a 106-mile post, and then there's at seven lakes, so there's a paired post on either side of the lakes. And then on two rivers, there's paired posts. So we know there's 124. And we've been, you know, spent about 7 years looking for them, and we've probably found about 11 or 12 of them. So you can find them if you look for them. 2007, our committee spent a lot of time going out and with a number of other volunteer surveyors getting GPS positions. So we got a pretty good idea of what's out there, but, you know, what the commission can do that we couldn't do as a volunteer committee is the state charged them with resurveying the line, recovering the posts. You know, we're doing a retracement survey. So we want to recover those and put a durable monument in. That's basically what the Act calls for. And they can contract, the two commissions could contract that work out. So I don't know how they're going to work that out other than both states have committed to spending $500,000 each to do the survey. So I really hope that, you know, is sufficient to get it done, you know. But we made up a budget at the beginning, and so we upped it and ended up there. So, and, you know, hope that works out good. But since we're working in two states, if they hire somebody, either it'll be contracted under Michigan law or under Indiana law, you know, because they'll have to be expending the funds from either the Michigan appropriation or the Indiana appropriations. So that's going to be an interesting process for them to work out. There are two state agencies that are supposed to support their work. They're set up as a commission just like a licensing board or, you know, other commissions that states have. Although, it's interesting. Michigan one says that the governor appoints them, but without the advice of consent of the Senate. So, he's the only one that can, you know, have anything to say about what they do. The legislature gets to appropriate the money.
So, what will you do? I mean, I'm assuming that the cost of the survey is going to be, or the survey itself is going to be conducted by professional surveying firms, I assume.
Yeah,
that you'll contract with.
Both statutes say that they have to contract with firms that are, you know, licensed in either state, one state or the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there won't be any from any other outside state. They have
sure.
to be licensed within the states. Yeah. So, but you know they. They haven't yet been able to meet. Probably the main reason is in Michigan, their appropriation for the first 2 years of funding to match what Indiana's already appropriated, that bill didn't get passed yet. that's expected to be passed this month or early April, you know, sometime in that time frame. So until that happens, the department that's supposed to support the Michigan commissioners doesn't want to take any action because, you know, there's been no funding officially appropriated yet. So it's a little bit of a, you know, you could say it's a little bit of limbo until that gets through. Yeah, there's a number of, when the state budget got passed, you know, it's quite a complicated process. So there are a number of things that didn't get done, you know, that they intended to. So now this supplemental bill is supposed to catch up with all the things that, you know, didn't get done but need to get done. So one of them was this funding for this particular bill. So, like I say, we're just waiting until it gets through the, you know, through the House and Senate, Michigan, which, you know, they're in session, so it should take place fairly soon. So far, we, you know, looking for corners, we recovered about a dozen of them, but I can tell you about a couple of them if you want to hear about those.
Sure.
Yeah, one of them was milepost 52. That was out in a swamp. It's still, it was a swamp back then, although Kendrick called it, what do you call it, a wet prairie. I've been to this corner. It's a tag alder swamp. I doubt if it's changed since 1827. So he was kind of being, I don't know, he might have been part realtor or something to call it a wet prairie. But anyway, they found the bottom of the post, the part that was always been underwater. It looked just like the day it went in the ground. You know, you could see all the axe marks on it.
Wow.
Yeah, that was pretty neat. Like milepost 17, the county surveyor perpetuated that back in the 1880s. Milepost 86, the surveyor went out. He wasn't looking for this. He was doing a survey on the state boundary, so he thought he had to look for the nearest milepost because Michigan and Indiana have two separate survey systems. The section lines will run south or north to the state line. And that was done within 1 to 3 years after the original survey. So all the these deputy surveyors, all their notes always say intersected north boundary of Indiana. So it was probably to them a visual intersection. You know, you saw the brush line, so that's the line as far as they're concerned. So anyway, what he thought might be one of the closing corners for a section line. So he measured over, I think it was about a quarter mile, looking for the nearest milepost, and he recovered one of the original bearing trees, a hickory. So, and when he pulled over from that, the record distance to the milepost, he found quite a large rock that sat there. And there were no county surveyor records in either state, so, you know, apparently some surveyor perpetuated it, but, you know, didn't make a record of it. So. And we looked for milepost zero, which Kendrick said was on the first sand ridge at Lake Michigan on the shoreline. He said he measured 2.5 chains east from the water's edge to the top of the sand ridge and hit a tree and scribed that. So we figured out where to look for that. And we got there, and a couple years before the Indiana County, there's a road runs right behind the sand ridge, parallels the beach in the lakeshore. So they had put in a catch basin and just dug through this sand ridge and ran their drain line out onto the beach, you know, for stormwater drainage. Hmm. They went right through the where a milepost zero is supposed to be. So whatever evidence was there is gone, you know, because they didn't look for it.
Well, we've got a minute or so left before our time's up today, so I want to be sure to thank you for joining me today. This has been very interesting. I'm sure our audience has enjoyed it. But what you've done is whet our appetite now. So somewhere along the line, I don't know how long this is going to take, but we'll probably want to have you back and get an update, or maybe it'll be finished in 5 or 6 weeks, he said jokingly. But at some point, we'd like to have you back.
The legislation provides... For a five-year time.
5 years. Well, we'll definitely have you back before that for an update, and then hopefully we'll still be around in 5 years. But I really appreciate you being with me today, Jack. It's been great.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Yep.
Take care.
Bye now.